The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And from Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
The Dover Point Cooperative is a manufactured home park in Dover, New Hampshire. Tana Pelletier knows it well. Three generations of her family have called it home.
I lived here with my mom as a teenager, but my uncle had lived in the park for a really long time. I think he moved here when I was like 12. He moved his trailer in, and he owned the trailer until he passed away.
2014,
so it'll be 4 years in May.
At that point, Tanya and her husband Keith bought the trailer from Tanya's cousin. And while the home changed hands, the space is still steeped in family history.
It was special because my aunt decorated it, and both my aunt and my grandmother, who spent the most of the time there, they actually passed away within the last year. And so it's kind of special to me because whenever I walk into the kitchen, even though we've replaced the refrigerator, every time I walk in there and I look at the backsplash, because that's still the same, I think about my Nana and I and my mom and my aunt.
Keith says that he and Tanya weren't necessarily looking to buy into the park, but at the time they were renting and paying a lot more for a lot less space.
Yeah, we were in this very tiny, what was it?
It's like 400
maybe 450 square foot apartment, and all the ceilings were
top of the house.
Yeah, at the top of the house. So you had to duck underneath, you know, certain spots. And, you know, it was pretty pricey, Greenland, New Hampshire.
So Keith, Tanya, and their young son Corbin moved in. Then something unexpected happened. The longtime owner of the park wanted to sell. In stepped New Hampshire Community Loan Fund's Rock and H program to help residents consider their options. One was becoming a cooperative, or buying the land collectively and owning the property outright, together.
Going through the process of becoming a cooperative is a highly emotional thing, much more than I think than people understand. There's a lot of fear of the unknown. You know, when we originally heard the price of the purchase price that was being asked, I think most of us fell off of our chair thinking, you want how much?
The purchase price was $3.125 million for the 79-unit manufactured home park. A board was set up to function as the head of the small, newly formed democracy. And where longtime owners had made the rules governing the park, now residents would all have a voice. And then came other changes.
It seemed that a lot of people started taking more pride in their homes when it became a cooperative. I saw a lot of painting, a lot of porch rebuilding, a lot of disposal of, you know, stuff that was in the yard.
Keith says that with the decision to incorporate into a co-op, the value of their homes increased. They also became eligible for other services and perks since the park was now resident-owned, like real mortgages. Most importantly, it gave the young family some financial breathing room and gave them more time to care for Corbin, who's now three.
He's got a speech delay and he has trouble swallowing and eating, but then he also has like delay in learning and some social stuff and some sensory pieces. So there's a lot in there, and he goes to some pretty extensive therapies during the week. And so being a homeowner in a really affordable space has allowed me to stay home with him. I mean, it's expensive to live, and I think a lot of people that we know are working. Both parents are just working really hard to stay above water, and I feel like that has really opened up an avenue to be able to just spend more time with him. We don't have to work so hard as a family. You watch those tiny house shows. This is like our version of a tiny house. You hear those people saying we want to work less and do life more. I mean, that's part of it, and he definitely requires more care, and that, you know, this has really allowed us to be there for him.
This is Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott. Independence is part of New Hampshire's identity, but so is a strong sense of community. This week, our Only in New Hampshire series digs into a question from a listener named Amanda that confounds those seemingly oppositional characteristics, the co-op. Amanda asked, what percentage of New Hampshire businesses are cooperatives? But before we dig into the numbers, we needed a clear answer on what exactly a cooperative is.
A cooperative is a kind of business that's accountable to the people who participate in it.
That is Nathan Schneider. He's assistant professor at the University of Colorado Boulder, and he's writing a book about cooperatives set for release later this year.
In some respects, it's a model that actually precedes the kind of corporation that we might be most used to, a corporation owned primarily by its investors for the sake of investor profits.
Nathan was covering protest movements, including Occupy Wall Street, when he noticed how activists were drawn to the co-op idea. It's a business model that began more than 150 years ago in this country. Lots of people are familiar with the consumer model, like the food co-op or insurance companies or apartment buildings. But there are also worker co-ops. Those are businesses owned by the employees, and purchasing cooperatives, like True Value or Ace Hardware Stores.
Not only is it a co-op, it's a kind of model that has almost single-handedly enabled small businesses, in this case in the hardware industry, to survive in a market dominated by big boxes.
You might be surprised by some of the businesses that are co-ops. The Associated Press, Ocean Spray, even Visa started out as a cooperative. After moving out to Colorado for work, Nathan discovered that his grandfather had been the director of a Colorado-based purchasing cooperative.
This is somebody who couldn't look more different from the protesters at Occupy Wall Street. You know, he was a buttoned-up, quite conservative man, and nevertheless, he was drawn to this same model that they were. It's something that I think is really fascinating and is a real opportunity that this model offers. It can bring together people around common values who might not think they have much in common.
Today, cooperatives are having a bit of a moment. Since 2007, the mutual and cooperative model has been the fastest growing part of the U.S. insurance market, for example, with about a 30% growth compared to 3% among non-mutual companies. Cooperatives have historically surged around the times of big societal changes. Nathan points to co-op booms after the Civil War, after World War II, and during the Great Depression.
You know, which saw one of the real tremendous upsurges, not only in cooperative development, but in government support for cooperatives. When, you know, the U.S. government was making propaganda films promoting cooperative models as a strategy for economic democracy.
Cooperative enterprises also gained steam among Black laborers and other groups left behind in that post-war boom. That idea of pooling resources to gain a seat at the table also guided one of the greatest freedom fighters in the nation's history.
Martin Luther King Jr. helped set up credit unions in places that he was doing resistance work as well. That story is less well told.
In the year before his assassination, Dr. King began organizing for radical redistribution of economic and political power, actions known as the Poor People's Campaign, a civil rights era crusade that was revived in 2017, a year when 82% of all wealth created globally went to the top 1% of earners. That's according to data assembled by Oxfam International. And their reporting points to the erosion of workers' rights as one of the main drivers of the wealth gap.
I think it's so important to recognize the disconnect that has been growing since, in particular, the 1970s, between the productivity and return to capital and wages. Wages have you know, corrected for inflation and so forth, have gone flat, while productivity and return on investment for investors continues to rise.
And as income inequality revs up, so do other massive social changes. Uber, Amazon, and the gig economy are transforming how and where people work. Google and Facebook are rewriting the rules of social interaction and of privacy. Nathan thinks these are opportunities for the cooperative alternative.
Right now, we have a need to start adapting some of these strategies that have been built up over time in the past and in other circumstances, and bring them into industries that are growing fastest and they're really transforming our world right now.
So where does New Hampshire, a state that prides itself on independence and local control, the home of the live free or die state motto, come in? That's why we found Amanda's question so intriguing. Producer Jimmy Gutierrez started digging around and found that there are lots of cooperatives in the state. So Jimmy, what were you able to find?
So it was really tough to find anything concrete on this. The last numbers I was able to find were a little bit dated. In 2009, the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Center for Cooperatives put together a breakdown of New Hampshire, and it showed a little over 200 operating cooperatives in the state. The majority of them were in housing, like the Pelletier story shows, but also a lot among credit unions, daycare, and even water management.
That's kind of surprising to me that there are so many. But how about Amanda's question, what percentage of businesses here are cooperatives?
So this is a little less impressive. Keeping things just at the local level and looking at last year's reporting on the state's small business profiles, which puts the total number of businesses at a little over 130,000. If my math's on, dividing 200 by that number puts us at about a 0.002% of small businesses in New Hampshire are cooperatives. But if there's a takeaway from the Pelletier story and Nathan's research, I think we can be pretty certain that we'll see a big bump in that number in the coming years.
One of the global leaders of the business cooperative model is right here in New Hampshire. Howard Brodsky's family owned Dean's Carpets, an anchor business on Manchester's North Elm Street. Howard's father died when he was 13, and the business sat in limbo until he finished college and then took over. There were some bumps in the road, along with the rise of the big box retail market, but Dean's Carpets flourished. Today, the family-owned business has evolved into CCA Global Partners. It's a multi-billion-dollar cooperative and the largest retail purchasing co-op in the country. Chairman and CEO Howard Brodsky is with us today to talk about how it works. Howard, welcome.
Thank you, Virginia. It's nice to be here.
Well, so glad to have you here. Now, because we've been trying to nail down during this episode what a cooperative is. So
right.
Would you like to add your two cents?
So a cooperative can be many things. In the business world, it's a business structure that's owned by its members. So the members, like in our case, the retail stores actually own the company. So even though I founded it and I'm the chairman and co-CEO of the company, I don't own a single share of the company.
Wow. So did they share in the profits?
Oh, absolutely.
And this obviously, if it's a large retail purchasing cooperative, it's not just your store in Manchester. It's stores across the country. They pool resources to buy?
So we do marketing, buying, store design, insurance, real estate, and we operate in four countries. And so we're very profitable. So we've have profit of over $1.6 billion. That's all gone back to the members.
This is really something. I mean, I don't know. How has it been operating so quietly, or has it?
Well, I think it has in its own way. Certainly the people that are part of the cooperative, it's not quiet. You know, I would say my mission is to save the family business in America, because it's not that the local entrepreneur is not smart and not talented. It's not a level playing field. If you can't buy it the same way, you don't have the same ability to have credit card processing at the same rate, insurance at the same rate, and store design and marketing, then you're not on a level playing field. We level the playing field.
Well, we heard a little bit about your backstory, right? So what is it, what did you discover about the traditional business model that wasn't working for Dean's Carpets?
It was becoming more where the big boxes were taking a larger and larger share. And we looked down the road and said, you know something, if this continues, our business will be just like so many others, going out of business, because the big box come in, they're much more scale, open 7 days a week, much more sophisticated with marketing and store design and training. And we needed to scale. We needed to get people together to combine to give us the resources, the same resources they could do.
Why do you think it works? Why do you think you have an advantage?
Well, I think co-ops have an advantage because they're owned by the people, for the people. It's capitalism with a conscience. Huh. So we're very entrepreneurial. We're very driven. There's no lack of drive in our company. You know what's interesting, Virginia? If you look today, six people in the world have the same wealth as half the world's population.
It's astounding.
And it's getting worse. It's getting worse every year. And so the inequality and the lack of opportunity is going to end up hurting American like we cannot believe. And that's why, you know, you see this huge anxiety and problems that are happening because people don't feel they have opportunity. Mm. And co-ops people give people, it gives them ownership, it gives them hope. What exists in America today is the extraction economy. And the extraction economy is people taking out of the system way disproportionate to what they're putting in. Probably a perfect example is Uber. Uber is worth $70 billion. And they just did a study, though. It was a study by MIT. The drivers of Uber, after you take away the insurance cost and the gasoline and the wear and tear of the tires and the amortization of the car, they make $3.65 an hour.
I thought Uber was all about putting the power in your hands. You'd make the money yourself.
No. Now, Uber Black maybe, but the millions of drivers are actually Uber, Uber X, Uber XL, are making less than $4 an hour when you take away all the cost. And yet the company is worth $70 billion. That's what I call extraction economy. It's extracting all the wealth and all the money out of people that are doing the work.
So you talked about values driving this. You
right.
talked about the idea of keeping family businesses intact. But I wonder for your family, you know, your father, you know, who grew this business. I don't know if it started with his father or not. But does it feel like you're letting go of something, letting go of ownership, something that was built when you started working on this model?
No. No, I never, you know, people have asked me, they said, look, it's a huge company. You must kick yourself that you didn't make it a private company.
I wonder about that. You could be making a lot more money, Howard.
Yes, and, you know, because the company's a billion-dollar company. And I never wake up one day without being happy because I see what it's done for thousands of other people and families. And there's a lot more in life than how much you have in your checkbook. And it's not that I don't do well. I'm the CEO of the company, but I don't own the company. And you don't have to own it to do well. And you don't have to have the most money to have a rich life.
Howard Brodsky, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Howard Brodsky, he's chairman and CEO of CCA Global Partners and chair of Cooperatives for a Better World. That is the nonprofit cooperative model website. We'll link to both of them at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, we're going to hear from some New Hampshire students who grew up getting schooled in active shooter drills. We'll find out what it's like for them to be part of the lockdown generation when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We're dusting off a favorite segment from Word of Mouth's past and rebooting it, thanks to producer Jimmy Gutierrez. Hey, Jimmy.
Hey.
So rebrands are not always a good thing in the media universe. What have you got in mind?
Okay, so we're taking the segment Overheard, which was kind of when you would come together and us producers, and we would just kind of share different audio findings that we have just kind of fallen in love with. And we're going to turn it into kind of like a community roundtable.
With locals?
With locals and local voices on local issues.
So that's great. I mean, definitely always worth hearing from. But what kind of conversations do you think we'll be hearing?
All kinds. The spectrum from serious to less serious, definitely. Our first installment here, it's a little bit more serious. We invited some high school students to kind of talk about the student-led movements, Never Again and March for Our Lives, and kind of what it's like to be a high school student at a time like this.
Yeah, this has absolutely captured the nation's attention, and there's a big march going on in Washington this weekend, many towns and cities joining. And just last week, thousands of New Hampshire students joined the national walkout a month after 17 people were killed at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School. Now, we've had a handful of threats made since at New Hampshire schools, too. So, Jimmy, who are we going to hear from?
So I talked with Jennifer White. She's a junior from Hopkinton High, and Jonathan Weinberg, who's a senior at Concord High School. I started by asking Jonathan about an experience he had that really gets at why some call these kids the lockdown generation.
So kind of just ever since I was born in 1999, the year of Columbine, and I remember in my elementary school, this was my first lockdown experience, but it wasn't just any lockdown experience. It was a real shooter was on our campus, and I can remember just, I was so young but still the fear within me was paralyzing. And that whole experience, I don't really think I could have expressed my real emotion because I was so young, but I can remember a few years after when I was in my middle school and my teacher, her niece goes to Sandy Hook Elementary, and she was getting live messages from her sister about how her daughter was in a real shooting experience. And my teacher, like, couldn't teach class during that day. It was just so scary and horrific. And now in high school, we've had multiple active shooter drills, and it really has been the epitome of our generation, the lockdown generation.
It's so wild to think about, because this is something very unique to this generation, really, and your time, which is unfortunate. And Jennifer, you wrote something for the Concord Monitor. Can you kind of talk about what inspired that and kind of what the message was that you wanted to get across?
Yeah, I just remember a few months ago, we had a lockdown drill at my school, and it was actually before the recent Florida shooting, but I was, for some reason, just really thinking about it that day. And it was just written about my experience in that specific lockdown and just sitting there. I mean, I knew it was a drill. It was very clear that it was a drill, but I was just remembering times in the past when I've had lockdowns where it wasn't clear that it was a drill. And I was just thinking about how all those kids must have felt when they were in real situations and, like, when it actually wasn't a drill. Just feeling like no matter how many drills you have, nothing can actually prepare you for an actual situation like that. One time there was like a lockdown at my school that wasn't announced that it was actually a drill, and one of my friends told me about someone she knew at another school who they had a drill like that, and she kept asking her teacher, is this a drill? And her teacher was like not allowed to tell her that it was, and she almost like jumped out of a window because she was so afraid that she was about to get shot, and she would have rather done that than get shot.
And Jonathan, you along with other students helped organize a school-wide walkout on the 14th, and I've seen photos of something like 1,000-plus students were out there. What is it about this moment, do you think, that's linked so many students across the nation to take action?
I think definitely since we're high schoolers as well, we can empathize especially with the high schoolers of Marjorie Stoneham Douglas, as well as just their courage to speak out and not really afraid for what might happen to them, and just showing that the youth really can make change. How the Marjorie Stoneham Douglas students, they wrote a bill and it actually got passed, which is so impressive, which I think is really inspiring to myself and other students across the nation, that we can stand up and make change as well. And we're just standing in solidarity to really show that we're all united and not divided.
With that said, there's been in some corners of the internet and within political parties, there have been criticisms lobbed at students. Things said such as adults must be instructing these kids. There's no way they could be doing this on their own. Some even have said calling the kids that are making these stands and the walkouts as a political tool. How do you respond to some of those criticisms?
You know, there will always be people who assume the youth are political puppets of politicians or adults. But additionally, I think adult guidance isn't necessarily a bad thing if it's not overarching. Like, students, we're young. We're always learning, and that's the beauty, that we're young. It's best when you learn a language when you're young, just like learning how to grow up. So the adult guidance, it doesn't mean that they control the whole thing. It means they just help someone grow up. And I think the students of Marjorie Stoneham Douglas, this whole nation is largely a student-led movement. We're all just learning who we are and coming together and growing up.
Jennifer, I'm curious. New Hampshire itself is a very libertarian state. You know, there are a lot of hunters. It's kind of a gun-steeped culture within the state. After your editorial and kind of those things, have you had fellow students challenge your activism?
Not specifically towards that, but I do know there have been people. In my school, there are definitely people that were a little bit split up on, like, the walkout. People have different opinions on that. A lot of people think that it's not going to make a difference.
And Jonathan, for you?
Definitely. For the Concord walkout, at least, we made sure to make it, we wanted to make it an inclusive event, so we tried to make it apolitical, so students really didn't feel obligated to have all their views figured out when they came out. And we wanted to use this event as like a launching pad for future events so students could kind of have this initial experience and then use it to kind of think more and like a walkout. What is it? And the historical significance of social movements. So we're going to use this to educate students in the coming weeks and tell them about the other options that they can have for peaceful protest and advocating for what they believe in, like on March 24th and April 20th. And there were many students, as Jennifer said, who just didn't really understand it or see how it was going to make change. But I think just by looking at all the pictures and seeing over 1,200 students and teachers and the community members out there, that you can see that it really was just an act of solidarity and showed the strength of our community.
And you kind of spoke to those, the March 24th, March for Our Lives, the April 20th, I believe this is in recognition of Columbine. What is the end goal here? Like, what would you both like to see done?
I just think it's really important that everyone remembers, like, doesn't forget about all the students and remembers that the students, how strong their voice is, and that we're not going to forget and we're not going to let the Parkland shooting become another forgotten shooting. We're going to keep fighting until we feel like we've made a difference.
Definitely a big difference for me is education. I think it goes back to education every single time. And like whether it is parents instilling on their kids kind of compassion, caring for each other, or in school just educating and helping kids create their own opinions rather than in like imposing them. Because that's another big thing about like why we did the event on March 14th, apolitical. We don't want to like impose any opinions. We want the students to gather their own so they can make their own informed decisions. So I hope one big thing is the students come out more educated. And I want to find a way that we can create a culture that people feel like they don't need to use their guns. So I think that's a really important thing that we need to think about and how to address that.
You guys are both taking these steps and being very active. I don't know how much of this is comfortable for you. I think for myself, every time I've put myself out on a limb, it has been uncomfortable. And that's just something that you adjust to, that feeling. But I would imagine a part of you is doing this for the generation coming up from you. Jennifer, I know we were out there and I saw your little sister.
Yeah.
What are your hopes for this kind of work for the younger generation?
I really hope it will make a difference. You know, maybe someday then students who are my age won't be dealing with the same things that I am. And this is definitely all this, doing this so publicly is new to me. And I'm definitely, there's times when I do get very nervous about it, but I try to remember I'm doing it for the younger generation, and most importantly, I'm doing it for all of the children who no longer have a voice, who got their voice taken away from them, and all the adults, just all the victims of gun violence who have lost that voice. I'm trying to use my voice as a voice for everyone.
I think just looking at the students of Marjory Stoneman Douglas, they're being like picked apart on a national platform by people saying awful comments, and if they can get picked apart on a national scene, why can't we get picked apart on a small local scene? Also, just it's really important to have just role models out there. I know when I was younger, or just a freshman in high school, I looked up to the seniors like a lot, who were like heads of the clubs I was in, and they like helped me understand how I can be that leader when I grow up. So I think just it's important for us to show the younger generation what they can become.
Producer Jimmy Gutierrez there, speaking with Concord High School senior Jonathan Weinberg and Jennifer White, a junior at Hopkinton High. After the break, when calculating the costs and benefits of living in New Hampshire, many count in commuter miles. We'll hop on the bus when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth. Your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Virginia Prescott. We asked our community of listeners what we should cover for NHPR series The Balance, which looks at the economic, social, and personal costs of living in the Granite State. One thing came up over and over again: the commute. Questions like, what's the story with commuter rail? Or how many New Hampshireites work in Massachusetts every day? And along with the questions came the war stories.
My commute from Sugar Hill to Manchester, New Hampshire defined me.
From Barrington, New Hampshire to Burlington, Massachusetts.
Concord to Boston to Dover to Boston.
It takes anywhere from an hour and 45 minutes to 2 hours.
Hundreds of hours of podcasts and NPR.
The traffic has just gotten so bad on 128.
Hit a deer, drove away with fur-trimmed rims.
And that is in good weather.
My cost-benefit analysis, priceless.
It's a necessary evil in my eyes.
One epic commuter tale came from right over the cubicle.
I'm Laura Kanoy. I'm the host of The Exchange on NHPR.
For nearly all of the 23 years that Laura's been hosting NHPR's daily call-in show, she's lived just over a mile from the studio.
8 months out of the year, I ride my bike. When it's snowy or icy, I usually drive.
Laura's husband, Steve Winnette, has no such luxury. His commute is like an ever-present third wheel.
There's our family. There's me, there's Steve, there's our two boys, and there is this other entity, the bus.
Steve works for the EPA at a building just a couple blocks from South Station in Boston. 3 days a week, he spends between 3 to 4 hours, sometimes 5 or 6, on a bus.
Thursday night is really bad. So now, when we're trying to make plans, we just assume Dad's going to be late Thursday night.
Word of mouth producer Taylor Quimby asked Laura, what's the latest Steve has ever gotten home from work?
9:30.
9:30 at night?
Yeah.
And this is him taking a 4:30 bus.
Actually, he took the 3:15. It took them 6 hours and change to get home that night. There was so much snow.
Taylor wanted to know, what keeps a person doing this? What does it take to make this kind of commute worth it? And of course, there's really only one way to find out.
It was 5:30 a.m. when I quietly let myself into Steve and Laura's place.
Morning.
How are you? Steve greets me with some early morning vocal fry.
The Christmas party was here that night.
And immediately launches into the story of his all-time worst commute. The one that Laura has already told me about.
And the commute was taking 6.5 or 7 hours. And
you can tell it's one of those extreme travel stories that people perfect over hundreds of tellings. But today, Steve's epic commute story serves another purpose. It's a high watermark, a record that I'll have to keep in mind for perspective.
So hopefully that won't happen tonight.
A few days before my planned commute to Boston with Steve, the forecast started to turn. By that morning, we were looking at 6 to 8 inches of heavy, wet snow, followed by freezing rain.
Oh, this is Taylor. Nice to meet you.
When we board the 6 a.m. Concord Trailways to South Station, Steve and I sit up front, where he starts pointing out other passengers like he's giving me a tour
Megan,
of the
can
office.
Can you raise your hand over there?
It's Hi, Megan. Hi.
She's a relatively new timer here.
New timer.
And this is Chuck.
Hey, Chuck.
Another EPA employee.
When the bus pulls out of the station, it's still dark. Like weird airport night drive dark. Somehow, Steve manages to turn what seems like an obvious downside of this commute into a positive.
Yeah, that's tough. But the other thing is, I get to watch the sunrise every morning. And that's great. I love watching the sunrise.
He comes bouncing in with the shoes over his shoulder. He must be a morning person. I am a night person. This is a big problem.
Carol Palmer Zumbrunnen is a professor of nutrition and oral health promotion at Tufts School of Dental Medicine. When she decided to commute to Boston, she considered it a temporary arrangement. It was a decision she made before I was born.
So what is it, 1979? It's almost 40 years. I'm the oldest living Concord Trailways bus rider that's not retired.
To me, Carol's four-decade slog back and forth to Boston sounds like an existential hell. After all, I can walk to work. But here on the bus, everybody's in this mess together.
We actually had parties at my house, commuter parties, and the commuters all came and the driver came.
Once, during one of those epic snowstorm commutes, Carol says the riders brought the party right onto the bus.
We all got sodas and some people got some little nips.
Steve has told me about these sorts of super commute antics. During the now legendary 6-hour holiday party commute, Steve and his troupe entertain themselves playing charades, or a riddle game that he calls Minute Mysteries. To a person who's grown used to a 2-hour commute, anything less is extraordinary. Anything more is just an opportunity to commiserate.
We're almost here. This is a miracle. This is a miracle day. It's because you're here.
Okay. So here we are in Boston.
That wasn't bad. That was pretty quick,
no,
actually.
We zoomed in, and I'm guessing that what's going on is that a lot of people didn't come in today knowing what's happening with the storm. Oh my goodness, I didn't even look at my watch. In at 7:15, that is unheard of.
To get from Steve's driveway in Concord to the steps of the federal EPA building in Boston, it took us 1 hour and 37 minutes. 4 by car, 1 hour and 20 on the bus, a few spent waiting and walking. It was, they all told me, a miracle. Garrett Nelson is a postdoctoral fellow with Dartmouth College's Geography Department.
Yeah, commuting flows are really interesting because they're one of the best kind of links between places, right? They're not only an economic link insofar as people earn their money in one place and then come home and spend it in another, but they also tell us something about how people are physically choosing to move throughout space.
Recently, Nelson and a colleague made an interactive map of the United States. They got rid of state lines and redrew the borders for 50 separate regions using commuter data from the U.S. Census.
And what we found is that the state borders, for the most case, don't actually tell us very much about where commuter relationships are happening.
On the map, commuting routes are highlighted with bright neon colors that spiderweb outwards. The regions themselves look like gerrymandered puzzle pieces. California is split into several parts. Montana, Wyoming, and the Dakotas are all grouped into one mega-region, and each one has a name. Ours is called the Mayflower region, and it groups together Maine, New Hampshire, Eastern Mass, and Rhode Island.
So it almost makes more sense to say that, say, Salem, New Hampshire, is part of the same state in terms of commuter flows as Boston, and, you know, Western Mass, Lenox, Lee, that area, is actually a different place.
Did you guys have fun making the names? I enjoyed them.
Yeah, it was it was a long day of Wikipedia and historical geography to think of those names.
Looking at Garrett's research, there are a couple of big takeaways. For one, people like Steve and Carol, they're rarer than you might think.
So there's 82,000 people who leave New Hampshire and go to Mass every day. 73,000 of them drive alone, and only 2,000 take some kind of public transit.
82,000 people traveling from New Hampshire to Massachusetts each day. But Garrett tells me only 8,000, about 10%, are actually going to Suffolk County in the heart of Boston.
The vast majority of them are actually working in Middlesex and Essex counties.
But even though most commuters aren't heading downtown for work, almost all of the people using public transit are. For folks working elsewhere, public transit just isn't as convenient as driving by car. Or at least, it doesn't feel that way.
So there's this kind of chicken and egg pattern, right? If the travel is easy, people will do it, but the travel will only be easy if there's a demand for it. And the demand only comes when people are doing it. Something has to kind of kickstart that cycle into being.
That's partly why New Hampshire Governor Sununu has reconsidered his position on commuter rail. He's backing a $4 million study on whether to extend commuter rail up into the southern tier. Whether it'll happen is anybody's guess, though. Garrett Nelson's map of the Mayflower region shows how we're all connected, economically speaking. What it doesn't show is how we're all divided.
How do you deal with a situation where the geography has really been tied together by these commuters, but the politics has not been tied together?
By 3:45 p.m., when I'm due to meet up with Steve outside the EPA building, the weather has shifted again.
I was expecting. Bringing an umbrella wasn't something I thought about.
Me neither.
But it's kind of like when school gets canceled and then you go, oh, it's not that bad.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, the proof, someone came up to me this morning at the office and said, are you concerned about the commute home tonight? I said, yeah, you know, Sounds like it might be a horror show. At least, we'll be in the bus, and we won't be driving a car.
On the one hand, everybody will tell you that the commute to and from Boston is taking longer than it ever has. But in other ways, the bus ride has gotten better. Nowadays, you can text home if you're going to be late. There's Wi-Fi, plugs for your phone, cup holders, which nearly everybody mentions.
Cup holders, you know, this one has cup holders.
All I care about is that there's a coffee holder.
Nice seats, I got Wi-Fi, cup holders, reading lights, all that good stuff. And stuff.
Even Laura Canoy, Steve's wife, sometimes envies his commute. Have you ever just thought about the amount of time difference that he has spent commuting versus...
But he's sitting on that nice comfy bus, like reading a book. I'm home, you know, breaking up fights between my children.
Yeah.
I'll sit on the bus with like headsets on and I'm not making snacks, I'm not washing dishes, I'm reading a novel. It's a nice picture.
Back in 2004, a pair of Swiss economists put out a now famous study called The Commuter Paradox. Basically, it says that people overestimate the benefits they'll receive when commuting long distance. According to them, a one-way, hour-long commute requires a 40% increase in salary to break even. But newer studies have shown that commuting by bus or train doesn't have the same negative effects. Users of public transit can get work done, read a book, use the bathroom. They can relinquish control of the stressful part, the car, and take back control of their time. But none of the studies on travel patterns can easily account for individual decisions, the personal math that makes people rationalize or reject a commute. When I was in college, I painted houses in the summer. I drive my boss's truck, sometimes out to jobs that were 45 minutes to an hour away. For some reason, I didn't mind. After I graduated, I moved to a new town and got another painting job. The commute times were the same, but I was driving my own car now, and I was being paid two-thirds of what I made before. Within a week, I found myself white-knuckling the wheel with rage on the way home. And 2 weeks after that, I was crouching on a roof during lunch break, and I found a little bat skeleton stuck between two shingles. I quit on the spot and drove home. It just wasn't worth it.
Well, the alternative is one, go someplace else, live someplace else, drive. Why would we want to do that?
As we drive, the rain doesn't turn to snow until Manchester. And with so many people off the roads because of the forecast, our commute home winds up being one of the fastest either of them can remember. From door to door, it only takes 2 hours and 20 minutes. Still, that's long enough that I run out of questions to ask. We start talking about weekend plans, long silences ensue, and eventually I ask Steve for a minute mystery.
A man is going home. He sees another man wearing a mask and holding something in his hand. He decides not to go home.
Does the mask cover his whole face?
Yes.
Does the man with the mask want to hurt the other man?
No.
Do you have any idea? You haven't heard this one?
No, I haven't. Is
he wearing... Even with an hour left to go, I never did figure it out. With good intention. Maybe I would if I had a longer commute.
That's kind of a tricky... Am I cheating?
I'd have to ask you to define good intention.
Taylor made some really good guesses, but did not know the answer to Steve's minute mystery. So if you think you've got it, tweet it to us, at word of mouth. And if you're trying to solve your own commuting riddle or have your own horror story to share, we're all ears. Send an email or voice memo to wordofmouth@nhpr.org. There are loads more stories from our Balance series on the cost of living in New Hampshire. You'll find him at nhpr.org. Deo Muano is one of those people who does so much you wonder, how does he have the time? Deo works 9 to 5 at a tech company in Manchester, and outside of that, he's a dancer, a choreographer, a teacher, and a speaker, often inspiring others to overcome their challenges with his own incredible story. Deo was born in Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was just 10 when civil war broke out there back in 1997. His father, who worked in politics, was assassinated. The Moano family feared for their safety and fled as refugees, eventually settling in New Hampshire, where he's been for nearly 20 years. Theo teaches across the country. He's been on Dancing with the Stars and TEDx stages, and next month his company will perform in Exeter. We caught up with Theo as the company rehearsed and talked about dance, hip-hop, and life.
I started dancing when I was in the Congo. So naturally, dancing to Congolese music, which is really like funk rumba, rumba style of music. And then when I moved to the States, right away, you know, I got thrown into the early 2000s, so boy bands were like popular. NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, you know, O-Town, 98 Degrees, like, you know, pretty much all the boy bands in the early 2000s that had choreography and really poppy music inspired me. And then eventually it was Usher, it was B2K, it was Chris Brown, and then also like Michael Jackson. So that was my initial introduction to American music and American dance, and I just wanted more and more of it. And then I had an opportunity to start join this program called Joshua Generation with Youth with a Mission. That was my exposure to inner city America outside of New Hampshire, and that's really where I got to learn hip hop firsthand from the communities that I visited. My style of hip hop is influenced by so many different styles. And hip hop is not like, you can't just put hip hop in a box. A lot of the hip hop dance movement comes from different communities. So for me, you're gonna see a lot of different fusion of movement.
So you pull, pull, and then you're gonna bring, kind of let your chest come up.
So I went to school for international relations, political science, and I knew for sure that politics played such a big role in who I was in coming to America. So I pursued that, I got my degree, and then I went back for my MBA. So I knew for sure, like, beyond dance, I wanted to be able to hold my ground. I just wanted people to know that, yes, I am a hip-hop dancer, but I'm also an educated Black man. I'm not here to just entertain you. Because what ends up happening is almost like, you get put in the box, right? Like, that's all you do. But then over time, like, the more I started to accept who I was, the more I started to just not care. I've overcome a lot of trauma in my life through dance, and I'm proud of it, regardless of what my education or business accolades are. I think it's equivalent. Hip-hop culture, hip-hop clothing, it's still intimidating for a lot of white folks. I experience it all the time. Like, example, like, if I, even the way that I'm dressed right now, caught up flannel and long baggy shirt, if I put a hat on and I go to like a Home Depot or like, somebody will definitely have a negative view on me based on how I'm presented. But if I wore a suit, right, like, there's times where I wear a suit when I go to work, like, people treat me differently. So I think in terms of entertainment, New Hampshire is very open to hip hop, if you can throw it down. But in terms of lifestyle, culture, I don't think New Hampshire is fully open to that. Naturally, the fact that I align myself with hip hop is a very rooted style of art that came from African American here in America. So, which is also a language for me that I use every day. So therefore, I do identify myself as a Congolese African, but I also identify myself as an African American. And then I also identify myself as a hip hop Deo, because hip hop is part of who I am.
Sound there from Justine Paradise's visit to a rehearsal for a dance, spoken word, and live music performance called Ignite, We Are All Human. Deo Moano and his company Movement From Above will perform Ignite on Friday, April 6th at the Exeter Town Hall. We've got a link to it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And that is a wrap. Today's show was produced by Jimmy Gutierrez, Taylor Quimby, Hannah McCarthy, and Justine Paradise. Special thanks to Brent Huth at the UW Center for Cooperatives, Steve Varnum from the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, and Zandra Rice-Hawkins from Granite State Progress. Music in today's episode from Blue Dot Sessions, Ryan Little, and Poddington Bear. Our executive producer is Erica Janik. Maureen McMurray is our lead choreographer for Basement Dance Parties. Do you have a burning question about New Hampshire? A scratch that we can help itch? Submit it to our Only in New Hampshire series. There's a link on nhpr.org. Or you can leave us a message with your name and phone number at 603-513-7796. We're on the Facebooks and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth is a production of NHPR.